Blog Talk Radio.
Can we hear it? Can you hear it? Assalamualaikum and welcome to this episode of A Time for Justice. This show discusses legal and current events in a roundtable discussion with legal minds. My name is Sister Pamela Muhammad, and I am an attorney. We like to discuss this country's centuries-long failure to apply, uphold, and enforce the laws, and the overall failure of the legal system to give justice, and the negative impacts these failures have had on Black people and their Black families. Ultimately, we want fair dealing. We want justice under the law. But all too is not the actions that we see. Our guest tonight will not make those excuses. We have a very interesting topic for you tonight. We're going to talk about crimes of violence and the need for conflict resolution. There's a great need for conflict resolution. So we want to talk about this, and we're not going to make excuses for any conduct, the racist conduct of our open enemy, nor will we make excuses for what's really going on in our community, because those are really just distractions from the truth. And the truth is the path to justice and equal protection. So let's talk about just, fair, and equitable solutions, which are in the best interest of the people. Again, our show tonight on A Time for Justice is entitled Crimes of Violence and the Need for Conflict Resolution. Now, you know, tonight I want to talk and give constructive solutions and information to prevent this hysteria that we're starting to see, that they're really trying to promote, the news media is trying to promote. We have talking heads promoting this violence that is, you know, occurring, but some people are trying to use this rhetoric to harm the Black community, not to hurt the Black community, you know, not to help. They're using this to try to demonize and attack us. And this time, we're going to look at constructive solutions and information that we already have in place, because this is the same cycle. We saw this in the 60s where they've been labeling our community unfairly. We saw it in the 90s, this labeling of our community. So this time, we're prepared as a community not to be distracted. And that's why we have a powerhouse panel tonight. We have lawyers, as well as a very distinguished minister who will be joining us. This minister has a professional, experience, loads of experience in so many different areas. And so he's going to be able to talk to us about conflict resolution and how that is definitely something we need to see in our community. And many people are doing it. So as I said, you know, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan he gave us some direction about how our people, see, we look at our people different, those black people who have conscience, who have heart, who do follow some of the guidance and the guidance of the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. So he's talked to us about how our people, they're righteous by nature, but wicked by circumstances in some instances. So, you know, we want to stop the beef. You know, there are people who are responsible who want to stop the beef, who want to resolve the conflicts and give real resolutions. So I'd like to bring on our panel for tonight. Tonight we have Atheel Muhammad, and Brother Atheel Muhammad has been on our show before. Brother Atheel is an attorney here in Houston. He is actually a graduate of Brooklyn, out of Brooklyn, New York. I'm sorry, he's born out of Brooklyn, New York, and he's a graduate from Lincoln University with a political science degree. He's also a graduate of Texas Southern University. That's where he got his Juris Doctorate degree in 2001. And Brother Atheel Muhammad does practice employment discrimination, civil rights, and other crimes when people have been accused. He's a very great litigator and a very awesome friend and brother. I'd like to open up Brother Atheel Muhammad's mic.
Brother Atheel. Good evening, and assalamu alaikum, and good evening, everyone. Thank you again, Sister Pamela, for having us on the show this evening. We hope that we can say, you know, one or two things that people can heed and be productive, and that the conversation is worthwhile. But and hopefully, what I have to say will be worthwhile. And again, thank you so much, ma'am, for the honor.
Oh, all praises are due to Allah. Thank you for joining us, Brother Atheel. And next, I would like to introduce our brother, Dr. Abdul Halim Muhammad. Brother Muhammad is the student of the Nation of Islam. He serves as the Southwest Regional Representative of the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam. Brother Abdul Halim Muhammad received, and I'm going to start with his recent first, he received his PhD in the field of urban planning and environmental policy from Texas Southern University in 2016. Brother Muhammad is also received a bachelor from Hampton Institute back some time ago, and Brother Abdul Halim also received a Bachelor of Arts in Political Science from Hampton Institute. Brother Abdul Halim is a native of New York, Suffern, New York, and he is the youngest of three children. He is a father. He has a wonderful wife and son. He's my minister, so I want to bring him up. Brother Halim has such a list of, you know, accomplishments. He's actually been on many television shows as a guest speaker. He actually has his own, he's the host of a show, Connect the Dots, which has been a favorite in the city of Houston for many, many years. I mean, Brother Halim, he's worked on many boards and the Gulf Coast Rails, and he's actually Metro Board. I mean, Brother Halim, you know, he's political. He is a sought-after speaker because of his knowledge and wisdom, and he's going to talk to us about some of his recent initiatives because he's always been a wonderful servant here in the city of Houston, and he's so well-known. So I'm going to go ahead and open up Brother Dr. Halim Muhammad, Abdul Halim Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Muhammad.
Wa alaikum salam. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. We hear you.
All praises due to Allah. Thank you, Sister Pamela, for that fine introduction. And I'm glad to be on with my beloved brother, Brother Atheel Muhammad. I'm really looking forward to this. I'm fired up already.
All praises are due to Allah, because as I'm telling people, this is my minister, and Brother Abdul Halim is such a wonderful personality as well. So, you know, it's an honor for me to list his accomplishments because he's such a, you know, a very personable brother. He's my minister. So I just want to, again, thank you, Brother Halim, for taking up your time to join us tonight as we discuss this very important topic. You know, so again, we're talking tonight about crimes of violence and the need for conflict resolution. And as we know, we're not here to demonize, as we see in the news, but we do want to look at this problem and we do want to talk about solutions. And that's something that I know that you've really been a part of, Brother Halim. So, I want to talk about why is there a crime problem, and I took this from an article that Brother Naba put in the final call. This was a June 29th, 2021, and he said that the crime problem remains a problem of people living through a lockdown that is unprecedented in their lifetimes. They have a loss of jobs, school function, abuses and conflicts in the home, a general breakdown in respect for order in society, and an uncontrollable urge for violence that erupts sometimes without real provocation. Road rage, mask rage, race rage, they're all hallmarks of the great nation that is quickly unraveling. Yeah, and I chose to look at it from that perspective because I think, you know, everybody is going through these instances because of the pandemic. Now, before we go into why is crime a problem, Sister Barbara Muhammad was actually going to be a guest on our panel tonight. And I'm not sure if Sister Barbara is on the line, but if she is, the great Sister Barbara from the city of Atlanta, who's another attorney, please, Sister Barbara, press 1 so you can get into the host queue. Again, if Sister Barbara is on the line, I'm asking that she go ahead and press 1 so she can get into the host queue. So let's talk about what you see, Brother Halim, if you don't mind. Can you tell us what you see in the cities or in the news? What are you observing about why there's a crime problem?
Well, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan teaches us that, you know, we have to look at the source of the crime, and really it starts at the top. Has this government ever solved its problems really peacefully? Mm-hmm. It's been at war since its inception. So the violence starts at the top. Look at the popular culture. Can you tell me one superhero that solves their problems without violence? Superman, Batman, Thor, Spider-Man, Hulk, any of them that solve their problems without violence. So it is, as H. Rap Brown said, our brother Imam Jamil Alameen said, that violence is American as cherry pie. But going again deeper, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan also says to us that hopelessness breeds violence.
Right.
And when you look at the condition of our people, and then you add all the things on that our esteemed editor of the finest newspaper on earth, Brother Naba Muhammad, said, when you add those factors in, and given the current circumstances, you have a volatile situation. And unfortunately, because we lack the knowledge of self, which the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan teaches us is akin to the knowledge of God, we don't see each other as God, so we will beat, shoot, kill, rob and rape one another because we really don't see each other properly because we don't know who we are and we don't know whose we are.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. That's beautiful. And as you were talking as well, it's like this pandemic and the frustration, and it reminds me of the study guide where we're taught to rise above emotions into the thinking of God. And so the frustration and because the responses to the homelessness, the responses to the lack of poverty, you know, or the poverty, the responses of people living in homes together, it's just really you know, it's a challenge. And so I agree with you, Brother Haleem, this unraveling. So, you know, Brother Thiel and I, this is a legal show as well. So, you know, we're really excited to have you on to give us that perspective of your background, you know, because we see this type of crime in, well, we see crime in courts, of course, and we see our brothers and sisters who oftentimes make up, you know, large amounts of the people. And we wanted to talk about how dispute resolution can really help with some of this, because so much frustration, so much emotional. And I ran across an author who actually tries to say that the law treats violence in black people. They actually believe that there's some deep disposition that black people have. They try to say that it's, you know, they actually, the law is saying we're character, it's a character trait. You know, so when we see these news medias pushing this violence and predators and all of this is really backed up in the law, because the law treats violent crime, of course, much more harshly than the nonviolent. But you try to assign black people as being just naturally nonviolent. Can you believe that, Brother Haleem? I mean, here we are living with people who are the original savages and violence and over 400 years of being violent, but the victim is made to be the violent one as opposed to us reacting from our circumstances, you know. And so go ahead, Brother.
This is the basis of the argument, you know, which is really on a high taught in law school and in our secondary schools, meaning our college level, is the critical race theory, because critical race theory is not a theory for us. It really is critical race practice, because from the very beginning, when they kidnapped us and brought us over here, they always, and this is something that we really sometimes miss in our own history. Our own history here, particularly in America, are filled with slave rebellions and slave revolt and insurrections. So they've always had this fear, because we outnumbered them in many cases in the South, and they always feared that their slaves rise against them. And as you check the history of the Revolutionary War, as you check the history of the War of 1812, as you understand Lord Dunsmore of Virginia, who was the governor of Virginia, where when the Revolutionary War broke out, Lord Dunsmore was offering slaves freedom if they would fight on the side of the British Crown. The same thing happened in 1812, the War of 1812. And they were so afraid during the Haitian Revolution that kind of revolution was spread to America. So when you look at the very essence, when you look at the Second Amendment, there are three areas in which the argument was for the Second Amendment. And even when you look at the language of the original draft, and I'll close that. I just really, you set me off, sister. But here's what I want to get across on the Second Amendment. Amendment, when you look at it, there are three things that they were concerned with. One was, of course, an invasion by the British, because they still had their eyes on the United States even after the signing of the treaty with them to end the Revolutionary War. Two, they looked at their own rebellions within their own country, such as the Shays Rebellion, and then later after during, I think, Washington's administration, maybe the Whiskey Rebellions in Pennsylvania. But the other thing that really caused them to want to have a well-regulated militia and the right to bear arms was slave insurrections. They already had slave patrols, and I know you're going to get into policing. They already had slave patrols, but they needed for the states to have the right, not to depend on the federal government, for them to have the right to form militias to put down these slave rebellions. And that's the essence of the Second Amendment. So yes, yeah, sister, everything that they believed, they felt, they feared, you find it in the law. Because the law really represents the mind of those who enslaved us, kidnapped us, enslaved us, and kept us in that position even up to this very day.
Wow, that is awesome. And yes, sir. And Sister Barbara is on the line. Sister Attorney Barbara, I've opened your mic. Assalamu alaikum.
Oh. Wa alaikum salam.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. So, Brother Halim, you brought up some really good points. I wanted to also bring out the part that, and Brother Thiel, this is something you'll find very interesting, how at this racist, you know, this mindset that's ingrained in the law treats violence in white Americans by looking at them as a product of their circumstances in which people find themselves. And as lawyers, we spend much of our time defending our clients with that same mindset because we know that drugs, guns, racism, we know that mental health now is becoming such an issue, homelessness, and all of these things are at the root of many times why we see our people, you know, as well as resolution, inability. But going back to how the law treats violence in white America, Brother Halim, you brought up the police, and this actually even goes into police conduct. They talk about how police, they're looked at as people who are, when they commit violence against us, police brutality is using the words like use of force or resisting violence, where oftentimes we know like what happened to our sister Breonna Taylor, who was murdered in cold blood by bullets everywhere, and they couldn't figure out why that was an intentional act. It was a reckless act. It was an intentional act. You see what I'm saying? So in the law, Brother Athiel, you know, again, I'm putting that out with you as well because we know that they always want to give the worst form of intent to our people. You know, we are these heinous, intentional, where it's never the negligent criminal or reckless, which a lot of times some of this crime of passion, not knowing how to do conflict resolution, is. Because, for example, Derek Chauvin, the one who was charged with the murder of George Floyd, he was not charged with an intentional crime. He was charged with a depraved heart. He was not charged with acting with the intent to kill. You know, it wasn't premeditated. It was reckless conduct. So, see, this, again, is a way that things are skewed when it comes to white people. Not to
mention,
Sister Barbara, you want to
yes.
Please join our conversation and welcome. Yes, ma'am.
Yes. When they look at black people, they see us in a different light. They think that we're basically criminals, and they just have a lot of negative preconceived notions about black people. And a lot of times when you call the police for help, that creates a problem because we call them and they turn around and they act as if they're coming to get us and we're calling for help.
Yes,
so,
ma'am. Yes.
Yeah, it's rough.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, that's why it's better not to deal with the police if we don't have to, you know. And the idea of conflict resolution would probably be much better for black people.
Yes, ma'am. And you're so right, Sister Barbara, and because at the outset of our conversation, we're talking about crimes of violence and the need for conflict
yes.
resolution. And what we're trying mm-hmm. to do is we're countering this argument that this is showing a need for police. Because anytime they start with this violence, it's being used to justify this is why they need more police. So you're absolutely right. And
mm-hmm.
that has just been, you know, just murder, genocide in our community. It's, like I say, the article that Brother Naba wrote was, the cops can't hide behind crime. Out of control cops can't hide
mm-hmm.
behind crime. And so this is at the root. Now, I know, Brother Halim, you talked about us getting into the police patrolling mindset, what do you have in mind? Because, you know, we talk about the brutality. We've seen this. What's at the root of how is that even causing some of the mindset of violence? Is it increasing the frustration that we see with our young people in the street, all this police brutality and that slave patrol mindset? Is that what you're seeing as well?
Well, yes, ma'am. Well, that's part of it. You know, what we there's a writing a book called The Perpetual Prisoner Machine, and it's written by Joel Dyer, D-Y-E-R, and The Perpetual Prison Machine. He identifies four entities. He identifies the media. And if you ever notice, if you're watching the morning news, the noon news, the evening news, the nightly news, if it bleeds, it leads, right? So when you really look at the fact that crime actually overall is down, it's violent crime, aggravated assaults, and gun violence that is on the rise, and homicides that's on the rise, which is concerning now. But
yes,
the media is the one that's feeding it. So what happens is the next entity are political pollsters. What happens is that they poll, and you know here in 2017, Sister Pamela, if you poll the citizens of Houston-Harris County, what was the number one thing? They would say flooding because we had just experienced Hurricane Harvey, right?
Right.
But now, as you saw Eric Adams become the apparent mayor that's going to be mayor of New York, is because he ran on what? Crime. Because why? That's what the news is pumping. Next thing is legislators and politicians who, when they talk to these political pollsters, they say, what should I run on? They said, well, you should run on crime. So they go into the legislature, truth in sentencing. They want to do bail reform, reverse bail reform, cash bail reform, all this kind of stuff. And the judges should be locking people up at mandatory minimums and all of that, so they can score these political points based upon, again, the political posters. And lastly, what we have to understand, Sister Pamela, and you and Brother Theo and Sister Barbara have battled this every day in the courthouse and courtroom. There is a vested interest in status quo. There is money being made by the judicial system. There's money being made by the bail system. There's money being made in the jail itself. Just think of it this way. In Harris County, black people make up 18%. Harris County, Texas, for those who are listening outside of Texas, make up 18% of Harris County's population. But we make up 48 to 52% of the jail population. So suppose we engage in conflict resolution. Suppose we had trade schools to teach and train some of these young men and young women that are in prison. Suppose we had adequate drug and alcohol rehabilitation programs. Suppose we had all of that and was properly resourced, not defund the police, but fund these community-based, asset-based treatments and interventions, and we cut the jail population by 50%. Now, the person who has the salt, pepper, and sugar contract, how would that affect them? So do you think they want to see a change?
Right.
I rest my case, Your Honor.
Yes, sir. You're right with that, Brother Halim. And actually, you know, this is a difficult situation because we are in these courts, and the script of pushing the violence and pushing the problem, this is what we don't really just want to focus on that tonight. We want to talk about the solutions, like you're saying, because we know that alcohol is usually one of the major factors in some kind of violence, in some type of blow up, in some type of dispute. And so we got liquor stores on every corner, you know, drug addiction, same thing, homelessness, you know, one of the things that, because we talked about crimes of violence. And so the code talks about criminal cases and criminal penal charges where violence is skewed when it comes to black people, because if you're sitting in front of a computer and you steal $1 million, you know, the classification is lower. But when it comes to a young, you know, some young person maybe going into a Circle K and, you know, pulling out a gun and stealing some gum, you know, that's armed robbery. That's, you know, punishable at much higher rates. You're going to prison for a long time, 25, 35, 45 years with that type of behavior. So, again, this is something that has been really skewed to make black people look like you all are the violent ones. You have a predisposition, which is just not true.
Right.
So, you know, yeah. So Brother Atheo, I know you and I talked about some of what Sister Barbara said about the calling of the police or how our clients are depicted, no mercy. And this is something, too, that we want to get across to the
well,
we want to jump in,
you know,
on this. Go ahead.
Sure. And you know, Sister Pamela, you know, as we've talked about this, you know, a lot of it has to do with, even as Brother Wyatt said last week, you know, that it is a way in which, you know, you poison the potential jury pool. And what I mean by that is, you know, with word association. He said this with the media, but it's the same thing. For instance, you know, as we know, if there's some attack, let's say some bombing or something like that, not you know, it could be anywhere, you know, some, you know, bombing in this country. If it's a person of Arab descent, he's called or labeled as a terrorist by the media. So now a potential jury pool already now thinks, okay, this is a terrorist. So now if I am representing that person, you know, as an attorney, now I've got that dichotomy to deal with. I've got to disabuse the potential jurors from thinking that this person is a terrorist. If the person is black, the media labels him an animal. Same crime, let's say.
Yes.
Same accusation. But the word association. So now in representing that black brother or sister, now I have to disabuse the potential jurors from thinking that this black man or woman is an animal. But if a white person does it, more often than not, they get the label of mentally disturbed. It's a calming thing. So now the media, so now I'm representing that person. Now I got to go into now mitigation mode. Okay, what happened? See, this is all dealing with, you know, word association and different things. This is why I tell people, and sometimes people laugh at me when I say this, but when people talk about, you know, what areas of law do I practice, and I tell them I represent people accused of crimes. And when most other people will say, you know, they're criminal lawyers or they're criminal defense lawyers, no, I represent people accused of crimes because I don't know if they've done it or not. We have the supposed, as we talked about last week, you have the supposed cloak of innocence. And so why now should I put myself in that same realm and thinking now that I'm a criminal lawyer or criminal defense lawyer? I represent people who are accused of crime so that the person that I'm representing, I am humanizing him or her to the jury. I am humanizing him or her to the public, whereby most times, as you know, Sister Pamela and Sister Barbara, and I know Dr. Halim knows this as well, when we're there, we hear words like the defendant, the client. Well, this person has a name. Humanize him. White people humanize themselves. But all of this word association stuff, that is how, in my opinion, a lot of this stuff begins as far as when we're already in the courtroom and in those criminal accusation settings. More often than not, if we really listen to it, the word associations and the words that are used to describe, as you were saying, Sister Pam, the crime, to describe, you know, the individual. You know, one thing with Mr. Chauvin's trial up there in Minneapolis, you know, that even the prosecutor referred to him as Mr. Chauvin. Now, when in the world did that happen?
Right.
Right. Every daggone time that I've been in, you know, trial and I've been, you know, as far as a criminal accusation is concerned, the prosecuting attorney, the district attorney, they always say the defendant.
That's right.
They never refer to him as Mr. or Mrs. That's why
right.
I always do. That's why you always do.
Right.
Humanizing it, you know, making the distinction and the difference.
Yes, sir. That's important because, again, and going into this resolution, conflict resolution, and the need for it, because if we look at the fact that they use this scheme to demonize our people and make it seem like we don't deserve sympathy because we're violent and these media portrayals and, like you say, this terminology that's used to describe our youth and our people, then that even affects us. Because I often have wondered why many of us are afraid of our youth and our people because of this perception. It doesn't just work on white people. This particular perception of fear and belief that our people are violent and hopeless, this is something that is in the black community as well. And this keeps us from going into these communities and, like Brother Thiel say, humanizing, seeing us as righteous. But maybe wicked under certain circumstances. So I wanted to throw that out there. There was an article written by Sister Nisa Islam. It's called Faith Over Fear. And she talks about how Father Flager, he leads some of these marches, and they go into the community, and they do just what you say, Brother Dale. They humanize. And they actually look at some of the responsibility, the absentee landlords. You know, they look at how the people don't have friends, and actually he used the term of the presence of God invading the neighborhoods, and it made me think, Brother Haleem, that perhaps the fearlessness, the 10,000 fearless that I know Sister Barbara they have in Atlanta that you're going to tell us some things about. And as well as, you know, Brother Haleem, your work is the need for us not to be fearless in looking at our people. I mean, of course, there's some real problems in our community, but we have to get out of this characterization that violence, we're violence, and so we don't deserve sympathy, you know. And so anybody want to jump in on that? Because I think that characterization goes into black people's minds when we look at our brothers and sisters suffering as well. Anybody have any input? I know y'all do.
well, of course. I mean, you know, I'm glad that Sister Pam, that you're emphasizing and we're shifting to the solutions.
Yes.
And
yes.
The solution is when the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan made the call for the 10,000 fearless in the lead up to Justice for L's 10-10-15. He didn't call for 10,000 fearless to go out and kill white people or kill police, but he called for us to get in between the gangs and the guns. And then he was further in Detroit at that Savior's Day, the next Savior's Day, where he talked about the 10,000 fearless, of course, getting in the gangs and the guns, and he talked about conflict resolution, right?
Yes.
Because I have a thing. I'm trying to coin the saying that, how can we rebuild Black Wall Street when there's bloodshed in the streets? See, violence is bad for business. Violence is bad for business, except for, you know, if you're in the police business. But anyway, so you know, he called for the 10,000 fearless for that, and then he went on to talk about once we've done that, then we have to address. At that time, he was specifically talking about our Arab brothers who opened up these stores. And they disrespect us, and they sell us all kind of bad food, and they exploit us. In other words, they're sucking our blood and not putting anything back in the community. And then lastly, he said, if we're going to get politically engaged, we have to have a political machine, which he called the Justice Party. So bringing conflict resolution, getting in between the violence, leads to economic development, which leads to political development, because as Minister Farrakhan told us long ago, politics without economics is simple without substance, but you can't have economics and you can't have real political movement as long as the presence of violence is among us, and we cannot resolve our problems through dialogue and through I would call it dialogue rather than debate. Debate is like winners and losers, but dialogue is enlightenment of one another. So that's my response to your statement, Sister Pamela.
Yes, sir. And for the callers, if any of the callers have any questions or comments, please press the number 1 and you can get in the queue and actually join this conversation about the need for conflict resolution. Sister Barbara, can you tell us anything about you as an attorney? You're in these courts, but you also have mm-hmm. been working on a lot of initiatives in Atlanta. Can you talk to us about what's going on there when it relates to conflict resolution and it just being in the community?
Man. The conflict resolution that I know about is the one that we set up. Minister Sharif set up a conflict resolution department where people with conflicts, they can contact the nation and we help them to resolve their conflicts instead of like trying to do it in the courts because you don't get the proper treatment. We know you don't get the proper treatment in the court because, first of all, they see you in a negative way. And the difference with having conflict resolution versus going into court is in the conflict resolution, we see our people the way they are and the problems they have, and they're not painted with a negative stroke. And this helps to remedy whatever the issues are. What Minister Sharif's organization is doing is we're going to interview the people with the conflicts, find out what the problem is, and we are going to help them to resolve their differences by we're going to use auditing also to help to try to resolve the problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's definitely a – because as an attorney, many times – and I kind of wanted to do this in a family law case background as well, so we're going to take that for next week or in weeks mm-hmm. to come, because a lot of times solving these problems is easier when you're doing it outside the courtroom, like you said, because that's where the mischief makers are. As Brother Halim pointed out, the bail has to keep getting paid. The attorneys, you know, they make sometimes more money by impacting, you know, prolonging, potentially not really pointing out real solutions because, again, if they, according to this author, Dr. David Allen Swanky, he says that white people look at black people like we're violent dispositions. So are they looking mm-hmm. at our hearts? Are they looking at us as being able to solve and build our community? And as you mentioned, Brother Halim, which is one of my big issues with the 13th Amendment, these urban centers we live in are unconstitutionally impoverished. So if they don't want us to do better, you know, this is a setup like this to fail. You know, it's a violation of the Constitution how we live in these communities. So to continue to look to our enemy for a solution, the courthouse sometimes is that place, and that's just true. Brother Thiel, I don't know if you want to add, but go ahead, Brother Thiel.
And it's one thing I remember, you know, Minister Halim said this at a lecture or in a lecture or during a lecture here in Houston some years ago, you know, that, and he may remember it, and you know, help me if I'm, I apologize if I'm misquoting, so please jump in, but when he was talking about one time, he was talking about the projects in New York, that you're building people on top of people, you know,
yes.
And so when that happens, you are automatically going to have conflict. You know, I grew up in Vandeveer in Brooklyn, you know, which is, you know, a housing project, you know, that housing development that became a project. But, you know, the bottom line is, you know, you've got the and you know, Sister Barbara, you know, you got the projects that in New York, and Minister Halim knows, in New York, they're high-rises, you know.
Yes.
In Chicago, they're high-rises. So now mm-hmm. there's a psychological bit to that. You build people up. You know, you build people on top of people. You know, and that's a powder keg ready to explode.
That's
so,
right.
You know, and again, I'm not. I remember Dr. Halim, you know, lectured on this. So this is part of one of his lectures, and that just hit me with that. You know, that's how we are all in these. You know, huddled up in these communities. And so even, let's say, down here in Houston, Texas, or perhaps in Atlanta, Georgia, you know, the high, you know, they may not be high rises, but it's still a government project to keep us herded in a particular community, knowing
right.
that then, as you said, Sister Pamela, with the the saying was that on every corner darn near, there's a liquor store. You know,
yep.
there's some other thing there. You know, you know, there was this book that I read. I remember when I was in college, you know, that had come out, Marketing Booze to Blacks. And the thought was that, yes, you had a liquor store on every corner in the black community. And darn near every corner, every other corner, you had a billboard that advertised liquor, malt liquor. What is that other Old English and all of these different things. You know, in the black community. So what is it that you're trying to do? What is it, what was
right.
the goal in all of those things? And now when you, you know, fast forward it, or you go, not, maybe not even fast forward, but you go, you know, further on down now, you look at, you have all of these things now in the black community. The drugs, we're living on top of one another. We're herded together. We have the liquor stores in our community. We have the bombardment of marketing of alcohol and liquor being marketed. Now, of course, now that but no jobs or low jobs. Now that leads to crime. And as Minister Ali was saying a few moments, right. Mm-hmm. And now, then it becomes a cash cow. So now the person who was in that particular environment got caught up in something. Now all of a sudden, now the cash thing comes in. I have to pay a bail bondsman to get out. I have to pay a lawyer, you know,
yes.
to represent me because I'm now in the county facility awaiting trial or awaiting whatever the next procedure is in court. Now that's where the free labor comes in. That, you know, you don't want the persons who are incarcerated waiting for just not to, you know, to sit down and do nothing. So now we're going to employ them, free labor, all of these different things. So the, all of this, and it's designed that way, in my opinion.
It is,
and we have to, you know, be cognizant of that. And sometimes, unfortunately, we play a role into that, as I often say. Don't give these people a stick to beat you with. And as I always say now, this is chess, not checkers. You've got to think a little bit wider and wiser to know that, you know, so that hopefully we can escape all of these traps that are already, you know, that are there for us and that are set for us. Not everybody who's born in the ghetto, you know, has to remain there, and not everybody who's born in the projects has to be there. But we also have to know that it's a design, but we can overcome that.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
So if I may, Brother
right
Phil brings up a great point in all of you. I mean, it's really it's inspiring what I'm hearing. But I think often we have to think back to Dr. Martin Luther King when he took his movement from the South and went up and lived in a tenement in Chicago.
Okay.
And at that point, he started being accused of anti-Semitism because he found out that the people who owned some of these tenements were Jewish. All right? And the kind of hate that he received going up to Chicago, living in that tenement, he said he'd never seen anything like it in the South. So here's the point. The point I'm making is simply, it boils down to this. He visited with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And what he noticed about the Honorable Elijah Muhammad's followers was, in spite of the fact that they might have lived in a quote-unquote ghetto, they were clean, they were decent, they were law-abiding, and they didn't have the same problems. So there's an old saying, you can take Negroes out of the ghetto, but you can't take the ghetto out of Negroes. So what the teaching does is, in spite of our environment, what it does is it has a civilizing, calming, law-abiding effect upon us, whereby we're able then to change our minds, and therefore we're able to affect our environment instead of our environment infecting us. And so that's something that we need to think about is, again, knowledge of self, which Honorable Minister Lewis Farrakhan teaches us, is akin to the knowledge of God. And last point I'll make is on this is the economics of it. If people are interested, I don't want to hear all that spiritual God stuff, man. I want to hear. Well, let's get to the economics of it. When Master Farid Muhammad visited North America and met the Honorable Elijah Muhammad in 1931 and raised up, according to our lessons, 25,000 Muslims in that area, I want you to go back and look at the do any study. Any of you can go on the Google machine and look up the Purple Gang. The Purple Gang ran the liquor. The Purple Gang ran all of the gambling, the prostitution, the numbers racket, everything. Now, when they arrested Master Farid Muhammad, they found in his hotel room all of these acceptance cards where he had gave names to all these black people. So let's just look at it from an economic standpoint. Black people stopped eating pork. Black people stopped using prostitution. Black people stopped gambling. They stopped drinking. They stopped smoking. They stopped using drugs. How did that impact the Purple Gang? So we've been dealing with these people since the 1930s. And everything that we're trying to do, they're countering us. The Million Man March, how do you gather nearly 1.8 million black men without a fight or an arrest?
Ooh.
Come on. Mm-hmm. And then everything that we're seeing is almost 180 degrees. It's as if a demonic spirit is taking over our community versus what we saw at the Million Man March, Millions More Movement, Million Family March, and 10-10-15. You see, these people don't have any interest, as Mr. Farrakhan has taught us, and we first must be brothers, is that the denial objective of the United States government is that we must never be effectively organized.
Yes, that's sir. It. You're right. Yes, sir. That's yeah, that's beautiful. Was someone else going to, Sister Barbara, were you going to say something? Okay. I was going to say also that, you know, our spiritual part is so important, Brother Halim, as you teach us so beautifully, because even with the study guide, I'm sitting here, you know, we're taught how to control our emotional reactions. You know, we're taught how to handle the emotional reactions. And so often this is at the root of so many of these criminal cases that we see. For example, when you look at domestic violence incidents. Now, this is really interesting because I don't know if many of us really know that domestic violence and child support, whereas I'm one of the first proponents that, you know, men should pay for their children for sure and take care of their children, as well as, of course, we don't believe in abuse and violence between men and women. Conflict has to be handled. However, the police and the district attorneys, from what I've seen, they kind of have a built-in tendency to break up families by maybe exacerbating these situations. By, you know, sometimes people make false accusations. And because the black man, of course, again, we're looking at someone who's looked at as being just what is, you know, disposition, characteristics of not, what you know, of having violence, then the courts will operate against that family. And everybody loses. The mothers lose, the children lose, because the father is then demonized. And these are schemes and plans that our people really need to look at. You know, it reminds me of how the brothers were taking out the house back in the, during welfare. And, you know, if you had a man in your house, you couldn't get welfare, so they hid. And you know, that destroyed families. So, you know, these are reasons why we've got to look at dispute resolution, conflict resolution, and making our own communities decent and places to live.
And, you know, Sister Pamela, If I may, you know, Sister Barbara was raised an interesting point a few minutes, you know, when she first came on, you know, and as you're talking about domestic violence, you know, you have a husband and wife, you know, as I, you know, y'all know, you know, certainly more than me, you know, that, you know, when you're, you know, you may not, every day may not be heaven at home, I guess, if, you know, with a husband and wife, y'all know better than me naturally. But the thing is that the playbook is, there's an argument, a disagreement, excuse me. We're not resolving the conflict. Now it becomes a heated argument. Now words are exchanged. Now we're going to call the police. Police come, oh, somebody's going to jail.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's a
shot.
Exactly right. Or, you know, the easy thing is somebody goes to jail. You know, that we
right.
hope that might be it is what it amounts to. But all too often or not, somebody can wind up getting shot.
Yeah.
Why? Because we could not resolve the conflict in our own home. We had to rely on, you know, somebody else who does not have our best interest at heart anyway.
Right.
And so now you get caught up in the criminal justice system because of I came home, I had a bad day, whatever the situation might be. But instead of sitting down and resolving the conflict, because that is the easiest thing, sit at the dinner table, sit on the bed, whatever, resolve the conflict. Don't let a third person come in to try, as far as law enforcement is concerned, come in to try to resolve your conflict, because all too often the end result, as we were saying, is not going to be good. But we have to, and so if we can even, you know, begin that part, or even, when we are dealing with our brothers and sisters, you know, in the street, you know, we have this big thing, our young people now are big into, you know, you dissed me. But if we really think about it, okay, you dissed me, and so we're not even thinking about, you know, the end result of this. So now you diss me, I'm going to pull out a gun and I'm going to shoot you. Now my life is over if I got shot. The person who shot me, his life is over because now he's in, you know, the court system. Why? Because we were not able to address and resolve our conflict because, as Minister Halim was saying, that we don't know who we are and we do not know whose we are. And so that's why the 10,000 Fearless, that's why the community marches against, you know, sometimes we may look at these things and say, you know, whatever. But man, those are starts. Those are something that we have to do. And as you continue to say, Sister Pamela, that all leads to, and Dr. Avery always says, leads to separation because if we're able to police our own communities, a lot of this
right.
falls by the wayside. And if we're
That's
able
right.
to police our communities and do these different things, then the economic side of it, from their standpoint, begins, you know, to the, just as you're saying with, you know, with the Purple Gang. You know, if you have everybody, it's like I remember we were in Mayfair Mansions in 1988, and the minister, you know, visited that housing development where we were in Washington, D.C., he said to us, he said, you know, yeah, we can, you know, patrol these neighborhoods, but if we are able to affect and get the people who, you know, who don't want, you know, desire drugs anymore, it's like, what is that thing in economics? I'm drawing a blank here, but, you know, like if you don't.
Supply and demand.
Supply and demand. Thank you. There you go. Thank you, Minister. That's exactly it. If you curb the urge for drugs, the drug dealer is going to have to go away because there's no more of a demand. And so the thing is then if we, you know, curb the demand, if we can go into resolving these conflicts, then the trickle-down thing is then it's going to directly affect us positively because we're not going to be caught up in these legal in this white man's legal system, because we've realized a way to resolve these conflicts on our own and in our own homes and in our own communities.
Yeah. And I think that's good, Brother Thiel. I want to make sure that if you have a question or a comment, and I'm talking to the listeners, please press number one and get into the host queue so we can take your question or your comment. Because I want to ask a real hard question to me is, why is conflict resolution not prevalent in the black community? Why are we looking at police, looking at these courts as being the first and only supposedly solutions to our problems, and it's not working? You know, I just want to share this real quick. You know, when we defend our people in these courts, like Brother Thiel said, our job is to humanize our people. Our job is to get the best results for our people. And if they're innocent, we got to get them found not guilty. But I think also we have to realize these white people in these court systems, they don't like us. You know, they're really not there to help. And so to see a white district attorney who is actually arguing about how she wants to help a community, and I'm not saying all, but oftentimes you know these people are racist. You know they don't care about us. And so we're bringing our problems to them. Why is conflict resolution not prevalent in our community? Because this other way, it shouldn't continue to be our only way to resolve our problems.
Well,
anybody have any input?
Again, he who gives you the diameter of your knowledge, Mr. Farrakhan teaches us, prescribes for you the circumference of your activity. So if we can't solve our own problem, we're always going to look external. In my studies, in practice of urban planning or city planning, there are two types of community development. One is called needs-based community development, where activists and advocates like ourselves begin to raise all kind of cane about what we need in the community. There is there is drugs in the community. There's guns in the community. There is AIDS spreading in the community, and STDs and poverty and on and on and on. And what happens is that someone from some major university will come in, write a grant, get the money from the Ford Foundation, get the money from the Rockefeller Foundation, and they'll parachute in our community like Captain Save a Negro, right?
That's right.
And our people being so needy, they will go to that clinic. They will go to that place where the people have the money and the resources to address their temporary pain. But once they have written their thesis, their master thesis, and once they have written or got the statistics for their PhD, then they leave and the problem still exists. That needs base. We're turned into clients. We're turned into customers. We're turned into statistics.
Right.
But asset-based community development, sister and brother, is that what we do is we identify the individuals, the associations, and the institutions that already exist in our community as assets, and then we leverage those assets to acquire or to address our needs, and that way it's an inside-out approach rather than an outside-in approach. But right now our people are looking to the very people that enslaved them, exploited them, robbed them, and murdered them for the very help, and that is the fundamental problem right now with our fight for so-called civil rights. Did not the Honorable Elijah Muhammad tell us in Message to the Black Man that no matter who, that the Civil Rights Act would not stand no matter who was president? And that was published in 1965. And then I must do one self-correction before I turn the microphone back over to you. I said that it was we must first be brothers, where I quoted the Honorable Ms. Louis Farrakhan says that we must remember that and never forget that the ultimate aim and denial objective of the United States government towards black people is that we must never become effectively organized. That was not we must be, it was all opposition to truth must be destroyed. That was where I got that from. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Oh, thank you, Brother Halim. I appreciate it. We're going to take this caller. We have Sister Mavis, and she has a comment. Sister Mavis, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam, ma'am. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am. How are you, sister?
I'm doing well, by the grace of Allah. Thank you for asking. First of all, let me say I am thoroughly enjoying the conversation and all the comments.
Praise to Allah. Yes, ma'am.
Yes,
praise
ma'am.
To Allah.
And being in being a licensed chemical dependency counselor and currently employed by the Harris County Sheriff's Office, I work in the county jail.
Okay. Mm.
And so, you know, right there in the trenches with the problem and see how the system just manipulates. I met a Hispanic gentleman today. He's been in the criminal justice system since the age of 7.
Oh, my gosh.
7 years old. And, you know, they take people's lives and wrap them around their little fingers and put their money in the bank. But as a chemical dependency counselor, you know, substance abuse is my number one concern. And I have a desire to use my skills to, you know, with my people. It's a God-given skill, because if I can go in the Harris County Jail and be any way successful with my counseling, all praise is due to Allah. And so I'm at a point where I want to target the community, target my people, teach them, because our people have to be taught how to live differently. They have to be taught first how to think differently, and then it'll culminate into their actions. And so my question, comment, and Dr. Halim, I wasn't at that round table physically, but I was there this past weekend. And want to be at the upcoming ones, because I want to be a part of establishing that asset-based deal that you were just talking about in our communities, to go in and, you know, seek out the – I think we have to seek out the core. Where is the core of the problem? And then, you know, take it, like you said, an inside-out approach. But I am so grateful for programs like this where the dialogue is targeting our community problems and the violence and the, you know, the substance use. It's really at an all-time high. And so my question is, how do we get started? Where do we start, Dr. Halim? Where do we start when we get inside the community? And, you know, there'll be some resistance. You know, I see it all the time. You know, sometimes inmates want my help and sometimes they don't. They all know I don't want that. And I'm like, okay. When I just looked at your history, in the criminal justice website that says you have so many possession cases until it ain't funny. So you've been in possession of some things that, you know, I might could help you with. But, you know, I can only help those that want it. There's a whole bunch of people that need it, but what I know is I can only help those that want it. And I want to get to as many people as I can, because I believe, I know that that is what Allah has me here to do. Not only is it my passion, I believe it's my purpose. And so how do we get started?
Sister Barbara. Sister Barbara. Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
I feel
that
if we have a conflict resolution situation, in a situation like that, you get to speak to both sides to find out what the problem is.
because when people get thrown in jail, there's no attempt to find out, you know, what's the dispute, what's going on. They just throw them in, punish them, and do whatever. But if you have a situation where they're doing conflict resolution and people get to express what their problem is, what their trouble's about, then you can work towards getting a solution. And more courts are developing these alternative dispute situations because that's the only way you can get things resolved, is dealing with the parties involved to try to remedy whatever their issue is.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
And a lot of the courts are even hiring attorneys to work in these positions to try to help the people resolve their differences. Because the courts, it's too filled up with people and nothing is being resolved. So with the alternative dispute resolution, you can come to resolutions much faster and reduce all the traffic, you know, in the court.
That's a good point. You're right. Yes, ma'am. We're going to take this next caller. We have Sister Marguerite, and she has a comment. Sister Marguerite?
Yes, ma'am. Assalamu alaikum.
Walaikum salam, ma'am. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I'm really enjoying the show. Really. And I just wanted to make a comment about how excited I am that you have a show like this. First of all, to talk about, to make a comment about my situation and how I got a crash course in the justice system and foster care.
Oh,
and I'm
yes,
not going
ma'am.
Into the whole thing, but my son is a single parent raised in the nation, had all of his children removed from his home. And the thing that got me through was, first of all, some words that the minister gave us when we told him what had happened as to the that they will be forced to give them back, which they were, because we fought like cats and dogs at every step, and we documented. And we were able to show the judge, you know, when we're unified, we can do what we want, because the judge all the way down in the juvenile criminal system, I can't call it justice system, he decides, and they all work hand in hand. The child protective services lies blatantly. I mean, I could go on and on about what we uncovered, but what helped get me through was really to study what was going on. As the more I studied, just the viler and the sicker it became. So they were forced to give me my grandchildren, who had 10 years of foster care, and they did not want to give them to me. First of all, because we were Muslims in the Nation of Islam, and I would not call my son an abuser. My question to them was, in what court of law can I testify that someone is an abuser and I didn't see anything? I have never witnessed him abusing his children at all. In what court of law, except in the juvenile justice, I guess. So I did not bend to what they wanted me to do, and they did end up giving my grandchildren back to me. And all praises due to Allah, they have been back with us. They've been detoxed. They've been debriefed, and they're doing very well back home with their father.
All praises are due to Allah. That is so exciting. Thank you for sharing, Sister Marguerite, because I know you were fighting that battle. And like you say, this whole labeling someone as an abuser, that's an example of a violent labeling classification put on people. And then that keeps them out of jobs. It keeps you from maybe ever getting your children. They label people as sexual predators. They label people as this and that.
Yes.
I'm just using some other classifications that are very similar without any proof or evidence. Just
any proof.
Their words.
And without
with
that, Sister Pamela, they would have thrown that in his face, saying, "Well, your mother thinks you abused them." You know,
right.
So it's like you're in a den of snakes, and you have to watch everything you say, every turn you make.
That's right. Yes, ma'am. Well, thank you for that, Sister Marguerite.
Yes, ma'am.
And you know, and I think because we're down to a couple of moments now, we're down to 15 minutes. We still have time. But I do think that not often enough is the crisis and the damage that comes from going through these systems. It's not looked at how it causes trauma. It causes damage. It causes people to become angry and violent. There was that report out of Ferguson, Missouri, that talked about how harassing and police stopping and these illegal traffics and stops and, you know, this all of this predatory, you know, like when I came to the nation, I can say that, I know that I came as damaged goods, and I had some, like, trauma that had been inflicted upon me from being in the world, from dealing with racism, from being unjustly accused. And oftentimes this is what people, we see people turn that on ourselves because we don't know where it's coming from, but then the system wants to ignore it. I think a really great example now, if you look at the talking points, they talk about violence, but they don't talk about the pandemic. They don't talk about the world unraveling and people's lives being turned upside down. You know, they don't even talk about the cause and the effect. And as Brother Halim was saying, and we want you to answer one of the questions, Dr. Halim, if you can, that Sister Mavis asked. But, you know, like you say, they take these studies, they build these projects, but no real change is ever done. You know, we see that with CPS. They've been finding racial discrimination in CPS now for the last 20, 30 years, but they're still doing it. So what good? Where are the changes, and how do we understand that we need to do different solutions? We need conflict resolution that's ran by us, for us, to make our own communities decent and safe. So, Brother Halim, I think the question was somewhat like any suggestions for those who want to help or, you know, or it, that's what I paraphrased it to say, please, you know, you're out here, you're seeing the pulse of the people, and what do the people need to know to make our people want to get more involved with building within the community and doing independent things that can help our people, like the 10,000 fielders, or like I know you're doing United for Peace walks and these different things. Can you share some things with us on that?
Yes, ma'am. Well, you know, again, the minister called for 10,000 fielders, right? On 10/11/15, the minister called us up to his suite after he had addressed a community meeting, and he looked. And I was sitting right in front of him. He looked me in the face and he said to myself and to all the ministers who got there, he said, don't let your local organized committee die. Don't let your LOCs die. And I took that as a command. And that's what we've been doing. So every Thursday, we're on Zoom right now, but every Thursday, if you would send me an email at ntellc@gmail.com or robertmohammed@msn.com. Send me an email. I'll put you on the email list so you can join us by Zoom. But we have our Justice of Elf Local Organized Committee, right? Under one of the umbrellas under it is United in Peace, which you mentioned, which is our version of the 10,000 Fielders. And what I've drawn from is best practices I've found around the country. Brother Sharif's 10,000 Fielders in Atlanta. Brother Abdul Malik or Tony Muhammad out in Los Angeles, United in Peace out in Los Angeles, the Newark Peace Agreement led by or participated by our student minister in Newark, New Jersey, Abdul Haq Muhammad. I looked at Brother Father Flagers. I'm looking at Brother Captain Dennis's peacekeepers, and of course studying the Dope Busters from the Mayfair Mansions. All of this, I'm one who looks at best practices. So I'm looking at all that to fit it in a Houston context. So yes, sister. So that's part of it. And if somebody, if you're in Houston, save the date of August the 28th. We'll be in Sunnyside for part two of our community roundtables. And what we're doing is we're showing them the Scott Street Peace Initiative that we put together, a strategic plan to deal with some of the most violent neighborhoods in Houston, Texas, from a community-based, asset-based point of view, and use it as a template to take to other places such as Greenpoint, Southwest Houston, the East Side, and, of course, Cashmere Gardens and Fifth Ward. This is what we're doing, sister.
Awesome. Thank you for that. And yes, sir, Sister Barbara Muhammad, I wanted to ask you. Now, Sister Barbara actually is an attorney who's been practicing since the 80s, and she's an attorney admitted to the Supreme Court of the United States. She's out of New York. She's had a law firm with Sister Dr. Ava Muhammad, as well as her husband, brother, her deceased husband, Brother Larry Muhammad, was also a prominent lawyer in the nation. Sister Barbara has helped in lawsuits with the nation. She helps the minister as well, but she actually filed part of that lawsuit they filed against the New York Post. And so this sister, we have to give her her recognition as just being such a beautiful sister and mentor to me as well. Beautiful, beautiful lawyer. And I wanted you to share, if you could. I mean, we're seeing pictures of Brother Sharif and the 10,000 Fearless in Atlanta. Looks like they're feeding the homeless. Looks like they're really doing work to rebuild and help the impact of some of the ills in our communities. Did you want to tell us anything more about this initiative with Brother Sharif, Abdul Sharif Muhammad, minister in Atlanta? Sister Barbara. Okay. Okay.
Can you hear me now?
Oh, I can hear you. Yes, ma'am, Sister Barbara.
Yeah,
yes, ma'am. Go right ahead.
Anyway,
right
Minister
ahead.
Sharif is doing a lot of different projects. He has he feeds the homeless every week. They can come and get cook meal, and they can also get groceries. That's one of the projects, and he's also like giving clothes. They come and they get clothes. And now he's starting the, he wants to start the alternative dispute, let's see, conflict resolution, I'm sorry. Because that way you have to talk to the people to find out what the problem is. In jail and in these other places, the people don't get to tell you what the problem is. It's the authorities who will tell you what, they tell you anything. But Minister Sharif is setting up a conflict resolution center where people will get in touch with the agency to bring their cases to us. And we will listen and find out what the problem is, and there will be services offered to them. They can get auditing if that's needed. We have auditors who will audit them to try to get to the bottom of whatever their problem is and resolve it. And hopefully that'll be it once it's resolved. As opposed to going into court, jail, whatever, and you come out and the problem is still there. And I saw this week that several courts are initiating this alternative dispute resolution. One is Ohio District Court. They're doing that now. They're even hiring lawyers as the people who are working to resolve the cases with the defendant. Because otherwise, yes, the courts are getting too packed with unresolved issues. And if you're able to resolve some of these issues, it clears the courts, too.
That's a good point. Yes, ma'am. And Sister Barbara, I wanted to say, I read your resume because at the beginning I wasn't able to, and I also have to acknowledge and give the greetings to your husband, Brother Eric Muhammad, just a wonderful brother, and please give him the greetings. Assalamu alaikum. And so in closing, yes, sir, Brother Eric, thank you. Yeah, wonderful. Okay, wonderful, yes. Brother. And so I know as Father Flager in this article Sister Nisa wrote, you know, she talks about how he talked about how this march was about stopping the violence, coming together in solidarity, regardless of religion, race, creed, no matter what your background is. Father Flager believes it's everybody's responsibility to come out here and be a part of what's going on. Either you're part of the solution or you're part of the problem, he added. And I think, you know, as Brother Halim was talking about models, that's certainly a model that we see in the city of Chicago, because we want people, as we're closing out, we want people to understand that as lawyers, this concept of how they don't see our people in these court systems by looking at them as a product of their circumstances in which people find themselves. And so that's our job in the community, not only as lawyers, but people in the community. This is how we can help our people. So please keep that in mind. And Brother Athiel, I want you to, if you have any closing words, we're down to 4 minutes, so I don't know if you want to say something, 30 seconds or more, and we're going to close
sure,
out.
You know, difficult for me, but I'm going to try my best. You know,
yes, sir.
As Minister Halim stated, that as the minister, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan said, we must first be brothers.
Yes.
And, you know, and I think that would, you know, begin to answer, you know, one of the previous callers, Sister Mavis's questions. You know, we must first be brothers. And, you know, I don't look at that necessarily as gender specific in that regard. I mean, we must first be, you know, brothers and sisters toward one another, of course, you know, because if we realize that, then perhaps we're on the right road. Because once we get in the criminal justice system, no matter in what regard, you know, it's not a good road to be in. And as Sister Mavis was saying or suggesting and could possibly attest to, you know, if she's still listening, that, you know, that young man who she was saying has been in the system since 7 years old. Now, what kind of life is he going to have when he becomes an adult? You know, you get our young people in, and so the employment is for us to put down the guns and realize we must first be brothers, but also that we are brothers, and we are,
that's right.
You know, our own.
Yes, sir. Beautiful. And like you say, also in these streets, we have to be brothers and sisters in these streets and learn to do better with our conflicts and stop, you know, any type of disagreement, because we got to unite. So I wanted to say thank you for listening to A Time for Justice. Brother Dr. Halim, Abdul Halim Muhammad, thank you so much for taking out your time. He is the Southwest Regional Minister of the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. We do thank you, Sister Barbara Muhammad, Attorney Barbara Muhammad from Atlanta, Brother Athiel Muhammad. We want you to know that you can hear previous shows by logging in to the Elevated Places Network featuring A Time for Justice. Also, please listen to Ask Dr. Ava Muhammad. Her show comes on every Thursday at 7 Central Standard Time. I would like to thank the Elevated Places team and network, Sister Samaya Muhammad, Sister Rona Muhammad, Sister Dr. Ava Muhammad, Brother Terrence Muhammad, Sister Donna Muhammad. And also, I would like to thank you once again for listening. And please tune in next week for more informative discussions. Remember, there's no us without you. And thank you again for listening to A Time for Justice. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.